Hello, everyone. I'm Keith Palm, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from the studios of PCJ Radio International. A student was killed at Lattes University of Technology last weekend in a sign of tensions at Papua New Guinea's universities, which has spiraled out of control. Last Saturday's unrest came after a series of clashes at PNG's three main universities this month, including a police shooting on students at PNG in Port Moresby 3 weeks ago, which hospitalized dozens. Johnny Blades has more.
Saturday's unrest came after a series of clashes at PNG's three main universities this month, including police shooting on students at the UPNG in Port Moresby 3 weeks ago, hospitalising dozens. Johnny Blades has more.
The Unitech community is in shock after Saturday night's attack. A mob armed with bush knives came onto the campus and entered a dormitory, leaving a first-year student who had been sleeping dead in an apparent targeted attack. They then set fire to various buildings on campus. By early Sunday, police restored control. Local journalist Scott Wider says that when police arrived on the scene, they were outnumbered.
Police tried as much as possible not to fire live rounds, so they used tear gas instead to disperse the crowd. It was pitch black. The power had been off for a few minutes when the attack began. It was raining very heavily, so visibility for police was quite difficult. So those were the conditions at the time.
Unitech's Vice-Chancellor Albert Schramm says it's unclear what motivated the attack.
What seems possible is that this is some type of revenge for the student who was wounded on the 13th of June in a short brawl here on campus.
That brawl had exposed differences among students about whether to continue boycotting classes, as they and students from the University of Goroka and UPNG had done since May, and their demand for the Prime Minister Peter O'Neill to step aside to face fraud allegations. In contrast to the lack of trust between the UPNG and its students in the capital, the Unitech administration has maintained constructive dialogue with the students since the boycott began.
Had nothing to do with the university council or the management. They were all outside issues, and there's only so much we can influence in that sense. Yeah, but of course we're very sorry that it came to this point where life was lost and the university buildings were destroyed.
The governor of Oro Province, Gary Juffa, is helping withdraw Oro students from all three universities in consideration of their welfare. He has warned about hostilities intensifying over the emerging divisions among students, especially with tribal grievances coming into play.
He's from a family, he's from a clan, he's from a tribe. They're grieving, they're weeping, they want justice. So during a time like this, this is when the police need to really step up and identify the perpetrators and have them immediately dealt with. At the same time, there should be an effort by the leaders to broker peace. They need to come together and say, look, we need to find a way to find a peaceful solution to these situations. And Parliament, which is abruptly adjourned, should be recalled. And all of us need to work together to find a peaceful solution.
The vast majority of Unitech students left the campus yesterday. Albert Schramm indicated that 3 weeks' time would be the earliest he would expect the semester to resume, and that this is dependent on whether promised government support materialises. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister has condemned the Unitech attack, saying his cabinet will meet to discuss ways to ease tensions at the universities. I'm Johnny Blades.
Papua New Guinea's ambassador in Jakarta says there is a change in attitude taking place in Indonesia's Papu region, or West Papua, whereby indigenous people are participating more in the running of their own region. Peter Lau this month visited the Papuan cities of Jayapura and Makere on the invitation of Indonesia's coordinating minister for political law and securities, Luhut Panjaitan. Also on the visit were ambassadors from New Zealand, Fiji, and Solomon Islands. He told Johnny Blades the visit was about witnessing the government's holistic approach in Papua.
Issues of human rights right across to issues of development, issues of education, issues of law and order, issues of funding, development aspirations, and having a strategic view towards linking Papua with the rest of Indonesia and the world, I guess.
Are you encouraged by what you've seen?
Oh, we're absolutely encouraged. There's certainly new trends, and the directions from the president here is very forthright, and he has an overall strategic plan, which the minister is now taking across to the people and taking leadership himself. Is connected, and people understand it, and people take ownership of these development initiatives that are now being put in place.
I mean, with your background, of course, you were the head of Papua New Guinea's military forces, and you know all about the sensitive issues. Would you say things are improving on that front?
It's the perception that has been portrayed outside, which really misguides all of us, including Papua New Guinea. Papua New Guinea Defense Force, in my time, and I'm sure it's still the same now, is that we had a very good understanding with TNI. We knew what was happening. From time to time, I try to explain to people that the so-called build-ups are actually their way of managing their border. They have the numbers, they have the resources. So when they move a large number of troops, it becomes obvious to people that there's a large mass of troops and equipment being moved. Whereas on the other side, we just have 100 men or 150 at the most. And when they move, it's just a group of people moving. So it's not as significant as the movements that are taking place on the other side, which is often misread. When you have 3,000 or 4,000 people moving at the same time, of course it raises attention. You know, when satellites pick up movements of people, they pick up movements of much larger signature as opposed to a small signature. But they've always managed it, and we've always understood from the PNGD point of view that they were just doing their normal rotation of troops, normal deployment, extraction of troops.
We see that there's a lot of support for the United Liberation Movement over there. What are you hearing?
Our observation here, and I'm sure my other three colleagues, Fiji, New Zealand, and Solomon Islands ambassadors will say similar things in their own way. Look, we're observing a trend, a show of attitude towards doing things for themselves. You know, the governors, the Bupatis, the regions, they're all indigenous Papuans. There's no Javanese or any other persons in the driving seat in terms of leadership in those provinces, districts, and village levels. Even the police and the military, there's more and more Melanesians now in there. The financial institutions, the businesses that are run, of course, it's all of Indonesia that's driving development and economics, banking, financing in Papua. But you see more and more indigenous Papuans are creeping up into management. The universities probably is a classic example. All the professors, lecturers, many of them are Papuans. So back to your question, I think this renewed sense of wanting to do things for themselves, a couple of things became obvious in the meetings. One is, and you probably noticed, if you haven't done so yet, there's an interesting article in Jakarta Post, I think last Thursday or Friday. It was done by the ambassador in Canberra, but Indonesian ambassador in Canberra, but it's also a view that was said to us in no uncertain terms. It was said to the four of us who were visiting in one of the meetings, that, and that's in the presence of activists, Papuan activists, you know, against human rights. Yeah. And they were telling us that, you know, we've had enough of outside interference with what we're doing. And when they say outside interference, they are referring to outside governments and even outside Papuans, the diaspora Papuans, who are constantly putting out messages that are not exactly what is being inspired on the ground here at home, what people want to do.
So was that the article which characterized the liberation movement as almost a terrorist group?
Yeah, that's the article. And in fact, during the meetings, a large number of files were brought forward, individual citizens, Papuans, bringing out evidence on a lot of the incidents that have occurred in the past. The so-called human rights incidents, and people were bringing in files, photos and stuff, and giving it to the minister and staff for presentation to courts for follow-up investigations and consequently maybe arrest of people who were implicated.
I mean, the Melanesian Spearhead Group has recognized United Liberation Movement as a group, and it's obviously in the MSG as an observer, so it can't be likened to a terrorist group, surely.
I think one has to see the outcomes of these investigations that have been brought out and the evidences that have been brought out. So what is now being shared in the media, and consequently when the parliament here clears their, what they mentioned to us, that the parliament wanted all these things, or the president wanted all these things, all the incidents that occurred before 2000 to be cleared. Once they clear a lot of these and the information becomes public, I think we'll be surprised to see who the real aggressors are in a lot of these incidents.
One big story this past week that's had a rippling effect around the world, including the Pacific region, is Brexit. 52% of British voters voted in a referendum to get UK out of the European Union. The Brexit exit from the EU will have little or no effect on the Pacific. That's according to economic professor at New Zealand's Victoria University in Wellington. Ian Knowles says that Britain, and not the EU, that was experienced the biggest impact of a separation since the EU, is a bigger player in the region and will have a greater effect on the Pacific. But with Britain's exit, it won't have that much of an impact. He spoke to Karori Hawkins.
I think actually not a lot. I think in general the fear we have seen in the last 3 days about the UK leaving the EU has, in from an economic perspective, has been overblown. This is not going to be a major, you know, calamity, economic calamity globally. The only country that will be affected significantly is the UK, and nobody else. That's my to a dramatic extent. And definitely in the Pacific, for the Pacific, the UK is not a very big trade partner. It's not a very big donor or aid partner. The EU is much more important for the Pacific. And I don't think that the UK leaving the EU is going to change much of that. Now, of course, if you can imagine a cascade of sort of disasters in which the UK leaves the EU and then France votes to leave the EU and then Greece leaves the EU and the euro collapses and so on, and then we can think of scenarios in which it is going to have a big impact on the Pacific, on globally, on everybody. But the Pacific is largely, I think, isolated.
Right, and maybe looking at indirectly at other things relating to trade and economics in the Pacific, like the Australia-New Zealand brokered PACER Plus free trade agreement that's still being negotiated. What about the ethos behind protecting sovereignty and some of the other issues, non-economic issues related to Britain breaking away, if it does, from the EU? Would that make an impact, do you think, on negotiations at this late stage in the PACER Plus negotiations?
You know, my guess, and I'm not a forecaster, and actually, you know, there's a famous economist who said that economic forecasting was invented to lend some credibility to astrology. So it's very difficult to know what the future will hold. But it seems to me that, if anything, there will be a backlash against, I know, xenophobic, nationalistic, isolationist sentiment that to some extent has been expressed in the Brexit vote. So I don't see everybody sort of, especially if you look at the last few days where, you know, the pound has collapsed and or depreciated dramatically, and then the stock markets have fallen significantly. That means that people are not viewing it as something very positive, which suggests that people will not going to say, people elsewhere in Australia, in New Zealand, in France, in the US are not going to say, oh, that's a perfect example. We should follow in their footsteps. So if anything, I would say that there will be a backlash and there will be an attempt to strengthen international cooperation in things like the trade agreements and the PACER Plus and things like that.
Going forward, which way are we heading now with all of this in terms of Britain beginning negotiations or even thinking of actually going down the path that the referendum suggests is the popular one?
The fears about an economic collapse are overblown. So even if they do decide to leave the EU, they will leave under conditions that will not change dramatically the kind of policies that they're already doing. So they're not going to renegotiate all their trade agreements with the rest of the world. So they're largely going to grandfather all their trade commitments through that they've made through the EU. The same is true for the financial system and so on. So it's not going to have the large economic implications. The one thing I think that is troubling potentially is that for a few years now we will not exactly know what will happen. And we know that, you know, when firms want to decide what they want to do and where to invest, they don't like uncertainty. You know, and that's going to be a problem for Britain. It's not going to be a problem for the Pacific because the UK is not a big player in the Pacific. It's not even a big player for Australia and New Zealand. What happens in Australia and New Zealand will affect the South Pacific a lot. But the UK is not even a very big trade partner for New Zealand and Australia nowadays.
Right, but the EU is a big player in the Pacific, as you were saying. And would Britain's, if it does leave, would that be a significant reduction in the money and the power, influence, etc., that the EU has?
To some extent it would, but, you know, the UK for years has been a sort of not the main pivot of the European Union, largely because they were outside the euro, right? Will it weaken the EU? Yes, it will weaken the EU, but the EU is still going to be the second biggest gorilla globally after the US. So it's going to be a slightly weaker gorilla, but unless more countries decide to follow in the UK footsteps, and I don't see that happening anytime soon, then it's not going to have a very significant impact on the EU. The UK was already a bit of an outsider in the EU to start with. It is going to weaken the EU, but only marginally.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The version of the program you're listening to now is the weekly 30-minute edition of the program. There are also three 15-minute versions of the program that are broadcast to the Asia Pacific. Now, the program that you're listening to now, which is probably on a delay, actually is going out live at this very moment at just after 15 hours UTC. But it's actually not 15 hours UTC where you are. That's because of, well, when this program is going out, if you know what I mean. All right. Palau has become the latest Pacific country to join the Regional Shark Conservation Initiative to protect shark and ray species in its waters from becoming extinct. Other countries in the region who are now backing the Pacific Shark Heritage Program by the World Wildlife Fund include Fiji, Samoa, and French Polynesia. Palau became the world's first shark sanctuary in 2009, banning all shark fishing in its territorial waters, and is looking at banning all commercial fishing by 2018. Ian Campbell, WWF's Global Shark and Ray Initiative Manager, told Injury Stewart he hopes more Pacific governments will jump on board.
We want as many Pacific countries to join up and get together to help them sort of conserve these important species of sharks and rays in the entire Pacific.
How likely is it to get other governments in support of this conservation effort? What are the barriers?
The barriers at the moment is getting to each country to inform them of what we're doing. We're currently based in Fiji. And it's just getting out to the countries to inform them. Once we speak to governments, they're very, very receptive of what we're doing.
Okay, so the main thing is educating them and letting them know, or raising awareness of the rates of decline of the species, especially sharks.
Yes, so I mean, people are pretty much aware of sharks being threatened by loss of habitat and overfishing, and there are lots of programs out there. But one of the messages that keeps getting lost is, as you said, it's not just about losing species; it's about a loss of links to culture and heritage throughout the region.
Sure. In terms of overfishing being a big threat to the declining rates of sharks and ray species in the region's waters, they're not specifically a fish that's targeted, in terms, so it's not like tuna, but they're really just kind of the waste catch. Is that what's happening?
They are and they aren't. So even though fishing vessels can go out and they target sort of species like tuna, you can set your fishing gear so that you do catch sharks, even though specifically you may not say you're targeting sharks. So you can fish for certain species, even though you can say you're not fishing for them. So not many countries do specifically target them, but a lot of sharks, especially in the Pacific, are caught. It's a huge sort of issue that differs from country to country and from regional water throughout the Pacific.
Right, so and how do you monitor that even?
This is probably the biggest issue that we're facing. In the offshore industry, monitoring what's happening on board the vessels is very, very difficult. So the monitoring of compliance to the rules is a huge issue. And also in small countries like Palau, like Fiji, coastal fisheries, You've got very, very dispersed countries with small islands and small communities. It's very, very hard for a small government with a undercapacity fisheries department to go out and see what's happening.
What are the rates of decline in terms of sharks and the ray species that are being threatened in the region's waters? Do you know?
Well, last year, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, their shark specialist group, did a study, a global study on all sharks and rays, and roughly a quarter are threatened with extinction. And also what was also a key finding for us was almost half of all sharks and rays, there's no data, there's absolutely zero data on if the populations are healthy, if they're overfished, if they're underfished, nothing. So it's trying to manage shark populations, especially in the Pacific, one of the big issues is the lack of data. This is why we're getting countries to back what we're doing. The more sort of momentum we can get of islands in the Pacific to really join up to focus where we can assist them, we should start making progress. We can start making progress straight away. With the lack of data, even getting small amounts of data is progress.
The United States and Pacific Island countries have agreed on a new fishing deal, which governs U.S. access to the region's billion-dollar tuna industry. The deal, which will govern U.S. fishing vessels across the region's exclusive economic zones, has been in the workings for 7 years. It provides more flexibility for U.S. boats to pick and choose the number and type of fishing access days that they want, while at the same time giving Pacific Island countries more control over their respective waters. The Director General of the Foreign Fisheries Agency, James Movak, says the deal is a huge achievement. He speaks next to Karori Hawkins.
In general terms, obviously, since it's still subject to ministerial endorsement, but what we've crafted is a restructuring of the treaty, which now provides for much more flexibility, which allows the Pacific Island countries to achieve the prices that they've been looking for multilateral days, or days that can be fished in all of the party zones, as well as opens up the opportunities for U.S. vessels to secure bilateral licenses from each of the member countries depending on their fishing needs and preferences. For the United States part, that same flexibility allows those boats that can't afford or don't need a multilateral region-wide access arrangement at high prices to instead secure bilateral days in the zones of greatest interest to them. So that flexibility on both sides is what enabled this to go forward.
It sounds like a very amicable agreement. Is that something fresh or new? I know you've been at loggerheads several times over different issues.
Well, amicable. It took a lot of hard work on both sides, I must admit. And really, we both parties had been under the general view that if we didn't reach an agreement in Auckland this last week, then the prospects of being able to continue the treaty would be extremely dismal, if not impossible. So the parties came in a much more constructive mood. As I said, worked very hard. There were a number of difficult decisions that had to be taken. But by and large, I think both sides achieved what they needed to secure in terms of the key principles and in terms of fair fishing access over the next 4 to 6 year period.
What bearing does this have on the early dramatic sort of mix-ups earlier this year with the U.S. pulling out of different agreements and what it agreed to pay, and then you extending it for, I think, a year is the current license, if I'm right?
Right, that's correct. And that was a major concern. That was one of the tricky issues that had to be resolved in this past week. So we sought assurances from the United States on the boats truly being able to make payment. Because we've restructured this treaty, so boats only have to get the number of days that they think they will need and be able to afford, I think the chances of certainly of large sections of the fleet being unable to make payment, to renege on their access commitments, is diminished. On our side, we've permitted a payment structure that we think is reasonable for the fleet, as well as meets our own needs and our desire for security of payment on our side.
Are you able to put any figures to the deal at this stage?
Well, I think the specific figures aren't as important in this at this time, Karoy, as the principle that this is a fewer number of days than in the previous years. It's significantly reduced from the old level of about 8,000 days that the U.S. fleet had at the multilateral region-wide level. That's been reduced down to 3,000 some days. And that number of multilateral days will continue to decrease through the period of the treaty, while the opportunities at the bilateral level, are expected to increase. And that's in line with what the Pacific Island parties, the members of the PNA-VDS in particular, have been looking for. And it allows the U.S. fleet, through this restructuring and making available both regional or multilateral days, as well as individual zone access, it gives them that flexibility that they've been looking for in terms of affordability and meeting their key fishing interests.
So would you call this like a huge achievement, a historic achievement for the region?
I think so. I think it's been a major achievement for the region. It is restructured the way in which we are licensing the U.S. boats. It's allowed us to continue the strategic political relationship between the Pacific and the U.S. on amicable terms. And it has, very importantly, it has reinforced and reaffirmed the commitment to regional solidarity and cooperation that has really underpinned the success of the entire Pacific Island region to date.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. It's very easy to contact us. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. Let us know how you heard the program, if it was on shortwave to the Pacific, by satellite, on the World Radio Network, or through one of our many partner stations. If you also have any story ideas, you can also let us know. And if you want to listen to all past editions, you can visit our website at any time by going to www.pcjmedia.com and then click on the link for Focus Asia Pacific. So on behalf of the whole team here at PCJ Radio International, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. Thanks a lot. Take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.